Hello, this is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American, and I'm here today with psychologist Dr. Emily Bascia. We're going to be talking to you about how it is that you rebuild your sense of agency. Now, we've done a number of series on this topic, including one that was talking about strength over safety, trying to find meaning over happiness. And today, we're going to talk about how you belong to something that is truly amazing, how optimism and patriotism are connected, and how when you give back, you not only help the other person, but you help yourself. You rebuild yourself. Now, if you like these messages and you want to help us continue our work, just press that subscribe button. It costs you nothing. We're not going to send you a bunch of crazy ads, but it does help us continue our work. Now, we're going on with our show. We're hopefully going to talk a little bit about hope. Welcome, Dr. Bascia.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Oh, thanks for being here. So we've had a number of great guests on our show. In the last couple of weeks, we had Peter Zeihan, who talked about what it is that makes the United States so great, what it is that puts us in a wonderful position throughout the world.
That was an excellent episode. Yeah, I really enjoyed watching that.
Now, he talks an awful lot about how our demographics, our geography, our institutions, all put us into this superior position, and the problems that are happening in China or Russia are really going to disrupt what's going on in the world, and it's going to change the global world order, most of that to our benefit. But I think sometimes what we really miss is what it is that really made America great, how it is that we really came to our greatness.
Now, how did we get here?
How did we get here? To me, that all begins with our Constitution. It begins, more importantly, with the focus on individuals. And I think that's going to be a big part about what we talk about today. It's been through the focus on individuals that we've created something that is really unbelievable in the world. We believed in the genius of individuals. We put that not only into the Declaration of Independence when we talk about we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they're endowed upon by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Meaning, we said that the rights of individuals were superior to the rights of government and, more importantly, to the right of the collective.
Yeah, and there were so many, you know, known and also unknown heroes throughout our history and time whose shoulders we stand upon and have fought and died for these rights that we get to exercise. And it is so connected to what we're trying to promote here, which is self-agency and empowering the individual and appreciating and knowing that you belong to something greater than yourself and the mental health benefits that come from contributing to that greater good and the collective, the individual benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a, when you think about again, where we are in the world, there's no nation that has prospered or has created as much wealth as the United States. It's just unprecedented. And when you begin to recognize where that comes from, you look back, you start to see the huge contributions that came from individuals. Edison, Henry Ford, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, what Elon Musk is doing today, these individuals that contributed massive amounts of people into the economic cycles that helped us build something great. Now, of course, it wasn't just them. It was millions of other people who, through property ownership, through home ownership, people who created small businesses, the people who kind of worry and struggle with what it is that they're doing on a daily basis, just trying to figure out how to make their payroll during the day. All those people, by us focusing on the individual, we created this environment where they created this very, very prosperous nation. And to me, there's no doubt it's their shoulders that we stand upon.
Yeah, and the group benefits. Yeah, I think of all the technology that is put into the iPhone, and even people living below the poverty line has access to this technology. And the amount of health benefits that come from and accessibility to so many things like knowledge and education and information, social support, social contacts, connection, communication, that all is through, you know, the benefits of Steve Jobs and what people have done with the advancements of technology. And those come from, again, preserving and protecting those individual rights and those freedoms that can be expressed through the free market. Excuse me. And it's so powerful because we see that there is this interdependence and this mutual benefit that comes about. And I'm not trying to say that one is more superior than the other. We should really focus on the benefits of the individual over the benefits of the collective. I think if we look at it even as a both and, if we focus on the individual, which the American doctrines and Western doctrines have, the group benefits. But we have to also look at the individual autonomy, the liberties, the freedoms, all of those things. You know, people have sacrificed their lives and committed their life's work and their passions to protecting those things. We'll talk about our heroes and people that come to mind. I think the Rosa Parks of the world and the Harriet Tubmans of the world and people who sacrificed.
Well, let's hold on this idea for a second. Let's stick with the whole collective thought. So if you think about the collective, if you look at China as an example, or socialist countries, oftentimes they believe that you have a government, and then the government puts the collective first, and that through protecting the collective, that helps the individuals. Mm-hmm. That's their theory, right? In fact, the King of England once thought that same thing. He said, look, my job is to make certain that I'm protecting the rights of the overall whole. Now, we had a guy who wrote a book or a treatise called The Social Contract, Jean Rousseau, and in it he said there had to be a balance between the what's in the best interest of most people and the best interest of individuals. So he said that we'd create a social contract where you outline the rights and obligations of both the government and its people. In the United States, we decided that instead of protecting the collective first, who would then help the individuals, that we would protect the individuals with the belief that that would help the collective. And when you start lining up those two systems throughout history, or at least throughout the last 200 years, and say, well, which ones did better? The ones that focused on the collective or the ones that focused on the individuals? Overwhelmingly, the societies that focused first on the individuals did much better. And through doing that, they definitely helped the collective. Mm-hmm. So when you think about...
There is the mutual benefit.
Yeah, when you think about what is the mutual benefit to someone coming up with the driverless car? So let's say mm-hmm. that ends up being Elon Musk first, or maybe it ends up being one of the other automobile companies. What happens through that is there will be massive amounts of social change that will take place. One of those social changes will be you'll wipe out the DWI industry. You'll end up reducing the mm-hmm. amount of deaths that are on the road. You'll end up reducing the amount of people who are maimed on our roadways. It will begin to create all different types of technologies through driverless vehicles that will preserve energy and that will help get us to our destinations faster. There are all types of human benefit that come from us allowing that individual to own what it is that they created, to make certain that we make that a priority. And there are actually two amendments in the Constitution that protect property rights for that very reason. It's not about the property. It's about the individual who owns that property and their rights being sovereign, being above the rights of the government.
Yeah, I love the work of Ayn Rand on this. And she does talk about if the society is built upon permitting the individual to go after their self-interest, you are inherently protecting the freedoms and rights of and liberties of all. And also safeguarding against government having too much power over the people. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, a large part of what she was advocating for is allow the individual to blossom and bloom and express their talents, find their unique gifts and abilities, and allow that to flourish, that there is this belief that the individual is inherently good and doesn't need to be regulated.
Yeah,
that was her belief.
I love Ayn Rand. I've read everything that she's written.
I believe it's Ayn Rand.
I'm sure I mispronounce it. Okay. I mispronounce every name you could possibly imagine. But in any event, but as you just said a moment ago, she wrote these two books that are very famous. One is called Atlas Shrugged. And the whole idea of Atlas Shrugged is that the world ends up creating the society that is based on the collective. Now, she came from Russia. She saw what communism
very
had done to them.
Very oppressive.
It was very oppressive. And she talked about how the train was late. It didn't show up on time. It was filthy. It was dirty. When it got there, it was unsafe. And sure enough, it wrecks and it kills a bunch of people. That's the beginning of the story of Atlas Shrugged. Well, I've been in a number of communist countries. I've been in Cuba, Russia, China. And when you get to certainly a place where communism is still in full force, like it is, was in Cuba 15 years ago when I was there, I can promise you it is much like that dystopian novel. There, you know, people aren't fixing up their buildings. There's no money being invested back into society.
It's motivation.
It's only as those countries open up to more free markets that they begin to see change. Now, her second book I like better, which was Fountainhead, because Fountainhead was about Rourke, who was this architect who had these beautiful ideas about
how
to create these wonderful structures that would really serve the public. But
as an architect,
government had created what were the approved types of architecture. And they believed that all the great types of architecture had already been created. So they gave you a series of genres and you had to pick from them. So you'd have to take a steel building and clad it with marble so that it might look like it was Roman architecture or maybe something that would make it look colonial, instead of utilizing the structure itself to try and help find the beauty. And Rourke wouldn't go along with it. And consequently, he was ostracized by society. It was interesting because you begin to see in reading the book that it wasn't just money. He was driven by something much more than money. He was driven by creating. Now, we talked about Viktor Frankl and the whole idea of finding meaning. In finding meaning, he said there are only really three things that help you do that. One is you have to find love. And you can love people, but you can also love things. You can love a sunset or the outdoors. He said struggle. You find meaning in struggle. But he also said that you find meaning in creation. And part of why I believe that you find meaning in creation is because when you're creating something, you are giving back. You're giving things back to general society. And that doesn't matter if it's a piece of art, if it's a song, or if it's a company that's innovating something new, or a company that's just simply providing a service to people. You are, in fact, giving something back to society.
Yeah, and there are the risks in doing so, in really finding your purpose in your life. Everyone has something very unique. Nobody is duplicated. And really, it's a matter of finding what that is. If your environment is constantly stifling you or oppressing you or treating you as less than or saying, no, you have to stay in line with everybody else, don't think of yourself as being set apart from the group, you may never have the confidence to really explore what that is. I did a lot of travels in my life, too, and one of the things that was quite surprising when I went to Cuba was that I saw people my age really stifled, and they were so bright, but yet there was this ambition that was, it was pulled back.
Unrealized.
Unrealized is a great word, because they saw there was no real opportunity for them to invest the energy, to advance themselves, to take risks. Education was provided for, medical treatment was provided for, but books were banned. They didn't have access to all the knowledge, and they were prevented from ultimately experiencing their full potential and their growth potential. And you see that damage on the human spirit. This is the freedom of being able to exercise what is inherently inside in each and every one of us. And I think this is what you're talking about, which makes America so special, is that it's full of opportunity. I mean, we're not saying that we all have equality here. It's not perfect, but oh my gosh, it could be so much worse. And look how great it is.
So
look at the opportunities we
have. I think there's
an
advantage to the pessimist. I actually think there is some good that comes from the person who's pessimistic, because what happens is they keep pointing out the problems in society. Now, in China, you're not allowed to point those out. So, the good news is in China, everybody's an optimist.
Because
you're not allowed to talk bad about the government. You're not allowed to talk bad about what's going on. In the U.S., we have people who will criticize things, who will say, well, we're not doing enough on climate change. We're not doing enough on human rights. We're not doing enough on equality. And all of those are important issues. They're very important issues. But every time they put them up, we tend to go out and work on them. And it's amazing how we begin to fix things. Here's what's undeniable. There is no nation in the history of this planet that has done more for human progress than the United States. Now, you can argue we're not perfect. You can talk about the terrible things that have happened here. And there have been some terrible things that have happened here. I don't want to take away from those. But as you begin to compare us to our peers, the question is, so where is it better? Where is it that you actually find this nirvana that you're talking about that's doing so much better than us? And here's the answer. It's never existed. This country has done more to protect individuals and human rights and bring more people into the system and to give more people opportunities than any nation in the history of the planet. And through that process, we became not only the most powerful nation on the planet, we became the most powerful nation in the history of the planet. And we didn't do it. It's fascinating to watch. We are becoming an empire. But yet we're not comfortable with that. We're not comfortable at all with the concept of being an empire because we don't want to run other countries. We don't want them to be under our dominion. What we want is to be this beacon that shows them how there's a better way and that how through focusing on the individual and putting the individual at the center, so much more possibility comes about. I think one of the greatest strengths that we have, you know, I look back at the human rights and civil rights movement, and there were people during that period of time who would have said how bad it was that we were doing that. In fact, I think you could create a very good argument that says this. If your goal was to protect the collective, then civil rights might not have been the right thing because there were a lot of people in society that didn't necessarily think that all people should be equal. But let's take it the long-term benefits of those civil rights.
Well, that's also, you're expressing the voice and opinion of those who had the power at the
majority.
Time.
Isn't that the collective? Isn't the collective defined by the majority?
It is one form of collective.
What's in the best interest of
the African-American collective?
Oh, absolutely. They don't
agree about that.
Which is why focusing on the individual is the better way to go about it. Because if you start with the individual, here's the answer. It doesn't matter if it's 1% of the population. It doesn't matter if it's 3% of the population. The individual matters. And those individuals in that 1% or 3% or 5% of the population, they have something inside of them too. They have a human spirit that we want to release. We want them as individuals to have all the same rights as everyone else. And when you focus on that, here's where it begins to help the collective. Think about the magic to this. Well, we went out and we said, we're going to create equal rights and civil rights for women and for African Americans and for
Hispanics.
Yeah,
with the suffrage movement,
and for the gay
permitting women's voting rights, also African American voting rights, those.
Guess what those people began to do? They began to buy product. They began to build new product. They began to invent
build businesses.
New projects. They built businesses, right? I can take you to places in the world where the idea is, no, what we need to do first is protect the collective. And the collective, in that case, may be defined as the party, or it may be defined as religion, right? It may be defined as why religion needs to be protected first.
Yeah, I understand your point is, like, you don't want to dissolve the individual's gifts, talents, abilities, and rights. That becomes the driving force and that the collective benefits, the civil rights movement, women's rights.
Collective.
Absolutely.
Long term. In the short term, again, you could argue that if you looked at what was in the best interest of society and you said, well, how do you define that? I can tell you King George defined it. Look, I'm going to do what's in the best interest of most people. And there's going to be a group of people who are going to be unhappy with that. And I have shut them up. Because if I don't shut them up, they're going to destroy what's in the best interest of most people. Of course they can't have the right to freedom of speech. Of course they can't have the right to freedom of religion. Of course they can't have the right to assemble because they might disrupt what's in the best interest of most people. We believe in the free market of ideas. Right?
And diversity of opinions.
and that there's
having that diversity
that comes from that. But
benefits
again,
the group.
It focuses on the individual. And if you go back and you think about that country, that hypothetical country we were talking about a moment ago, that's focused first on religion, here's the answer. Women can't participate. Minority groups can't participate. Other religious groups can't participate. And so what happens? They're not as productive as we are. They're not as powerful as we are. There's a magic to this.
Yeah, there. I think the absolute benefit is as you're trying to assess, and naturally as humans, we have to have a comparison. Well, okay, if we're saying that this is better, what do we have in comparison, or what other countries are doing it differently, and how do we compare which one is better
saying,
for the individual?
I think what you're saying is if you think that the United States isn't perfect, what's the comparison? What's the comparison? Who is it that we should be matching up to where this nirvana exists?
But we're also great.
There's where we're more than great.
We can be, right? We can also be imperfect and constantly striving to improve.
We're called a more perfect union, not a perfect union, a more perfect union. We're striving towards that. And we still have a long way to go on things. But I think you have to start with, if you're trying to build a you belong to something greater, that what you belong to is amazing, you have to think about, well, what is it that I do belong to? And maybe even start with this, why is it so great? Well, here's a reason it's great. We're more prosperous and wealthier than any nation in the history of the planet. How did that happen? When you get to how did that happen, the answer is, oh, because we focused on the individual more than any other society in the history of the planet. We built this social contract that, again, wasn't perfect, but it has been incredibly empowering to more people than at any other time in history. You belong to that.
Yes.
It's an amazing thing.
Yes, and you get to contribute to it and then reap the rewards and benefit as a result.
Mm-hmm. So when you think about our heroes, you know, I'm a,
yes.
I love our founders. I love Washington. I love
Lincoln.
Lincoln's not a founder, but Thomas Jefferson, Adams, Madison, the people who put together the country in the beginning. I love Lincoln also because of what he did on the Civil War and preserving the Union. And you might argue that he's a founder simply because the nation was ready to fall apart when he came.
Abolishing slavery and all that he was able to.
But you have to ask the question with any of these people, well, you're calling them heroes. Are they perfect? You're calling these people perfect, or you're calling these people heroes. What about if they owned slaves? Or what about if they were adulterous? Or what about if they were, you know, if they had scandalous parts of their financial records that maybe didn't play out? And here's the answer. Look, they're heroes in the United States because they focused on the individual. Martin Luther King is definitely one of my heroes. I love Martin Luther King. And I love Martin Luther King not just because of what he did to move the African-American community forward, the black community forward, not only because of what he did on civil rights, not only because he was a strong advocate of it, but because he talked about doing that with love. But he advanced the idea that individuals, each individual deserves dignity. He advanced the idea that all men are created equal. Now, in doing that, was his life perfect? Oh, goodness, no.
Yeah, he said, judge a person by the character, by their character, not based on their race.
But if you went to his personal life and you dug through it, you'd be astonished at some of the things that he did. And some people get really upset when you do that because they say, no, this is one of our heroes. Yeah, he's one of our heroes. And yes, he had a flawed life, but he's our hero because of how he advanced the rights of the individual. Well, let's go back to Thomas Jefferson.
Wait, I want to talk about Harriet Tubman.
Sure.
So, you know, another person, a wonderful, just a fighter, a freedom fighter in our history. And again, you know, as you were saying, not only did she, what she did and her sacrifices benefit her people, she did so to benefit the quality of life for all. And we all advance because of what she had done. So she escaped slavery herself. She went back to go and save her family members. And one by one, one person at a time, it was about 300 people that she had freed from slavery and brought them up to the North. And even on top of that, she went in and was part of another movement to help liberate 700 slaves at another period of time. But it's so powerful what she did and what she committed her life's work to. And she was buried with military honors because of what she contributed. And again, she was considered the Moses of her people because she led them all from slavery to freedom. And again, not just what she did for African Americans, but also what she did for individual rights and mm-hmm. freedoms and liberties. That saying that this is inherently about protecting and preserving humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were many abolitionists who existed inside the United States before slavery was ended. And slavery is mm-hmm. definitely far and away one of the biggest scars on the United States. No doubt about it. It had an incredible effect on our moral standing. All right. And it's something that we should all look back on and say that was just wrong, that it is not, that there's no way, shape, or form that we can justify that. But we should also think about why. Mm-hmm. Why can't you justify it? There were people justifying it back then. There were people justifying slavery back then, partly based upon the idea of the collective.
Well, they benefited from it.
They benefited from it. Their society benefited from it. Mm-hmm. Their communities benefited from it. Their economies benefited from it. And they then created arguments that said, hey, slavery is as old as mankind, which, by the way, is true. It's as old as mankind. You're Jewish. The Jewish population was enslaved by the Egyptians. And we just came back from Egypt. And I can tell you there are people in Egypt who deny that, right?
Absolutely. I was shocked when I heard that. Oh, you know, people are choosing to be enslaved
because they enjoyed it, right?
The great Pharaoh has requested them to participate in building of the pyramids.
There's no justification for it. But
absolutely.
Why? Why is there not a justification? And the answer to that is...
You're depriving a person of their free will.
An individual.
The autonomy.
You're taking something away from an individual. From a collective standpoint, you could create an argument as to why it was right. And I can tell you, if you go to China and Russia, you will find arguments for the collective that are being made and that are surviving within their governments that are based upon, hey, this is what's in the best interest of most people. So you can't speak up. You can't talk. You have to stay in some area where maybe you want to move away from. You're not going to be able to live the life that you wanted to live. That is a form of slavery. Right? It's a form of slavery. We say we're going to protect the individuals. Now, when you decide to attack the United States, when you decide to talk about how bad we are, how bad our founders were, how everything that we did was immoral, when you try to cast us in that way, you have to be careful with this one concept. You're attacking the one place that put the focus on the individual that made slavery, the whole concept of slavery, immoral in the first place. I'm not saying the United States made it immoral. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that the concept of individuals, each individual deserves dignity. Each individual has a certain set of rights that it is endowed upon by its creator with, mm-hmm. is a concept that made slavery immoral. Be careful about overthrowing the group in the world that does the most to try to protect that without thinking about, well, what's the alternative? What am I going to get instead if I'm successful at debunking the group that has been the largest protector of the individual? What it says to me, I look at Thomas Jefferson much like Martin Luther King. My answer to Thomas Jefferson is, of course he led a flawed life. Of course there are things that he shouldn't have done. But he wrote those words. Mm-hmm. And he wrote those words to a king. And in doing so, he became the biggest advocate in the world at that time for why individuals should be placed at the center. That's why he's a hero. That's the reason. Washington, why is he a hero? Because he fought for that idea and won the war for us on it. This is about the long struggle.
We have an incredible
history. Individual. And when we look back on our heroes, if we look at them through that focus, it becomes very easy to say who helped and who harmed us.
Now, you met Rosa Parks, and I want to hear this story. But I think, you know, she's another great hero in our history that we have to honor. And this is another perfect example of a woman who refused to get up from a bus and stand up so that a white person could sit down in her seat. And she was arrested. And at that point, Martin Luther King organized a mass movement, and they boycotted riding of public transportation. People were walking to work. They were taking taxis. They were carpooling. They were finding other means. This lasted for more than a year. For one person to protect the individual, the whole community mobilized in Montgomery, Alabama. Eventually, the case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that they're finding that segregation in public transportation is no longer lawful. And if you just see the what they worked for, how that group mobilized, again, to protect those individual rights, and now we have that Supreme Court ruling and all the benefits of civil rights based on what had happened back then. Now, you got to meet her. Tell us about your experience, impressions of her.
So we were fighting to get the Martin Luther King Day established in Arizona by a vote of the public. Mm-hmm. And as I had said in a prior podcast, the NFL had decided to pull the Super Bowl from us, and it became a fight with them. And I knew in that fight that if our people were focused on the NFL punching us in the nose, they'd just want to punch them back. And that may mean that they vote against the Martin Luther King Day again.
And this is while you were mayor of Phoenix.
While I was mayor, correct. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do was to, instead of focusing them on the NFL, I wanted to focus them on the concept of love. And in doing that, the first thing I did is I punched the NFL in the nose, told them to stay out of it. Right? There was a guy named a guy who ran the Philadelphia Eagles at the time, who was just incredibly incendiary in his comments about Phoenix and it being a racist place. So I called and figured out that he...
I love how you were using the word love and punching the NFL in the nose in the same sentence.
Look, it's I said this again in our concept on...
We are contradictions. We're walking dialectics at times. It's okay.
Agape, which is one form of love, doesn't mean that you're sitting down and you're hugging all the time. It means that you try to understand where they're coming from. Now,
yes.
The truth is, the NFL, many of them had the exact same sentiment that I had. They wanted us to pass it. But there were other people who really didn't care if we passed it. They just didn't want the Super Bowl here because they thought it financially benefited them for it being someplace else. Mm-hmm. And in this case, when these incendiary comments came out by the Philadelphia Eagles owner, I called his dealership and figured out that he was open on Martin Luther King Day. Mm-hmm. My answer was, if you're the moral watchdog of the NFL, why is it that your car lot is open on the holiday? If you believe that it's so important, why don't you close it? Now, this was the goal, to get my people off of being focused on the NFL, because I knew that was a loser. Mm-hmm. Instead, I wanted to focus on the reasons why Martin Luther King was important to us. And to me, the reason he was important to us is not only civil rights, but that he did it through a peaceful resolution. He did it by, instead of insulting other people, by calling them brother, right? And that to me was very, very powerful. So one of the speakers that we brought here was Rosa Parks. And Rosa Parks, she and I got on a bus. There was nobody else on the bus at the time, but she and I, and we we drove to the Civic Center where she was going to give her speech. And I had a chance to have a wonderful conversation with her, really get to know her. She is very much an understated woman.
Yeah, I saw some interviews with her, and I thought, wow, this woman, she's so powerful. And look at all the movement that she was able to promote based on, you know, one stand of defiance, one act of defiance.
She,
you know,
wouldn't move. Now,
it's one at a time.
There's this picture. And in this picture is of this this police officer. He's got the leather strap across his chest. He's got the crew cut haircut. His eyes are just precision.
Piercing.
And he looks like the almost a fascist individual who was arresting her, right? So I asked her this question. I said, man, I'm looking at this picture of this guy, and he's just so
hostile.
Radically looking, so hostile looking. And she said, now, Mayor Johnson, you leave that young man alone.
This is the person who arrested
okay. her. Oh, I said, yeah. I said, this is the person who arrested you. She goes, he was just doing his job. Mm-hmm. He wasn't immoral. The law was immoral.
Beautiful.
Right?
Yes.
And she said, he was polite to me. Oh, he yeah. was kind to me. Uh-huh. He made certain that I didn't get hurt in getting off the bus. Oh, and she said, but it was the law mm-hmm. that was wrong.
And that's what they're working on changing.
Right?
Yeah.
Rosa Parks, to me, we brought her here to help us sell our message. But when I met her and spoke to her, she inspired me in a whole new way. And the way that she inspired me was, it's we're not going to fix this by calling, you know, there's this thought that somehow or another, when we disagree with other Americans, that we should label them. Right, so we label them as Trump-tards or Lib-tards, or I mean, they've come up with a whole group of names that I don't even want to go through, just because some of them are so horrific. But if you want to be patriotic, why don't you start with this? Quit insulting Americans, right? And I was insulting an American. To her, I was insulting that officer. And her answer was, no.
Who you were seeing as her oppressor.
Right? He wasn't the oppressor. He was doing his job. He got up. Worked 8 to 5,
again,
did the best that he could do. That's right. She gave me a different perspective. And the perspective was, it's we, not me.
Yes.
It's not my movement that matters. It's not the black movement that matters, or the entrepreneur movement that matters, or the women's movement.
It's our community.
It's our nation. It's our flag. It's our country. And we're standing on the backs of these giants, on the shoulders of these giants that have given us an unbelievable perspective, an unbelievable wealth. But don't disrespect what came before us, and certainly don't disrespect other Americans simply because they disagree with you.
Yes. Yeah. And in times of great calamity, tragedy, trauma, people can be brought together in such powerful ways that promotes healing, it promotes group cohesion, it promotes harmony, it promotes patriotism, it promotes this need to contribute, because you feel and know that you are part of something greater than yourself. We saw that after the September 11th attacks. There was huge surge in patriotism. Many people were wearing flags, having U.S. flags in their houses, outside of their
benefits
on their lawns.
To this concept of we versus me, to the concept of patriotism.
Yeah. So looking at there was one other thing I just wanted to add, and I'm happy to go there. There was also a huge surge in people enlisting in the military, because they felt such a strong national pride, but also this desire to want to preserve and protect what the U.S. stands for, what American pride stands for. And it was a beautiful thing. And the fact that people are enlisting in the military, this huge surge, they didn't have to do any promotion, that people wanted to defend their country because they felt that it was under attack. There are many benefits. So there's social identity theory. Originally, social identity theory was looking at the harm that groups or prejudice or out-group conflict, intergroup conflict, or transgressions towards outgroups, we could see a lot of negative things that come about as a result. But in the last decade, there's been a lot of research looking at the benefits of positive group membership, group cohesion, feeling like you belong. There is this reflexive process that happens with the groups that you identify, because it informs and shapes how you see yourself. If you belong to parenting groups, if you belong to sports groups, if you belong to entrepreneurial groups, if you belong to hiking groups, I mean, there's so many different kinds of groups that are religious groups. The way to get the benefit, the research says, it can't be like a Facebook group or a social media type group. You do not get the same benefit or value out of it. It has to be one that you physically participate in and things that you attend So that you're having connection, physical human connection with other people, that you feel like you get to express yourself and be heard and valued and respected, that you're contributing in a meaningful way, that you're giving, you're sharing your wisdom, your knowledge from your experiences, that you're maybe giving something physical or tangible, and in return you are receiving something that can be symbolic, but it also can be in the form of social support. So there's a lot of mental health research that is looking at the benefits of resilience, the social support, increase in self-agency, having greater sense of power and control, that there's also some research showing that people, it'll prevent a relapse 1 to 3 times more likely if you belong to some kind of positive group membership. Those are powerful statistics, and that's why we see things like 12-step groups or AA or NA or other recovery groups being so powerful, or group therapy, that they're preventing either mood episodes or relapses on addictions and substances. I see loneliness, and we talked about this in our last episode, as one of the biggest detrimental mental health risk factors that we have in this time. It is such a consistent theme that
Help me understand that. Help me understand how loneliness ties into belonging and ties into you're a part of something bigger.
So, yes. So just imagine that you have a family member who you love. This could be your mother, it could be your father, it could be an aging family member, or it might be a granddaughter or a grandson or even a child. There's a huge increase, well, we're seeing some significant rises in adolescent suicides, teen suicides, and there's a tremendous amount of loneliness in this population. And just imagine that you have a daughter or a son. They're locked up in their room most of the day. They don't come out or share meals with you. They're not really talking to you about what's happening or what conflicts they're having. They're barely attending any family functions. They're not working. They're not going out with friends. And you kind of wonder, like, what is that person even doing in their room all day? I can't even imagine, like, it just must be so boring. But yet they're just surfing social media. They might even be the victim of some cyberbullying or other social comparisons, and they're destitute. They have, they're deprived of self-esteem. They don't have anything they're looking forward to. There's this utter sense of hopelessness and helplessness. If on top of that, you compound that with depression or even trauma, and they just have nothing that they're looking forward to, where is that motivation going to come from? They're significantly at risk of suicide. If they're even thinking about it, how would you even know? They're not even mentioning it to you. They're not having any conversations. Where is that social connection to feel like they're loved and valued by other people? For them to even to express, I love you, to another person and get that social reciprocity back to confirm and affirm their life matters, who they are matters. If they're totally disconnected and socially alienated, they are at risk. The point is, we need to move them out of those isolated spaces. If you're in there, if there's someone that you know and love and care about, the goal is to move them out of those spaces.
Help them find connection.
Help them find connection. And it starts with one person, getting them connected to some other groups. It could be a family group. It could be a religious group.
This is not directly related, but at least it sparked this in my mind. When I had lost the race running for governor, I always like to say I wanted to run for governor in the worst way, which was what I did. I lost. But the point is, I remember I was standing in this line, and there was no individual that I fought with during the time that I was there more than Senator McCain. Senator McCain and I, first we had philosophical differences, but there was just this animosity between the two of us. So I went to an event. He had lost the run for president against George Bush. I had lost the governor's race. I'm in one group, he's in another. He walks by with a security detail. We see each other and gave kind of one another a not a great look when we pass one another. And then he did something that I wasn't man enough to do. He told the security to stay there. He turned around, he walked back over to me, and he stuck out his hand and he said, Mayor Johnson, he says, I want you to know. He said, oftentimes, because of my time in a prisoner of war camp, I only saw things as good versus evil. Hmm. I only saw people in terms of good versus evil. And I mm-hmm. didn't treat you right. I want you to know I'm really sorry. Hmm. And he shook my hand, my chin. I don't know if I even said a word. I don't know if I even said thank you. I can't remember.
Kind of mumbled something like,
and he walked off. Well, from that, we built a friendship.
Yeah.
Right. And that friendship lasted for 20 some years until he passed away. Yeah. It doesn't mean that we agreed on everything. We certainly didn't. But mm-hmm. I gained so much from him. And one of the stories that I gained that I always loved was I asked him one day when he had cancer and he knew that this was going to be a tough fight and it was starting to have physical effects on him. And I asked him the question. I said, so what's your hardest day been? And he goes, oh. Mayor, he said, he's always called me mayor. I hadn't been mayor for 20 years. He said, oh, mayor, he said, since I was a POW, he says, I don't have any more hard days.
Mm-hmm.
He says, every day mm-hmm. I have, I appreciate. And I said, well, tell me about the hardest day there. And he talked about the story. It's a story that you can look up online. But the story that caught my attention the most was he had done a heroic thing by when they had told him, because he was sick and harmed and arms were broken, that he could go home, that they were going to let him go home. He refused to go because the code of conduct was that the first person that had been captured had to be the first person released. Well, when he refused it, of course, his dad was admiral, and so they were kind of wanting to embarrass the Americans in the first place. They began to torture him, beat him. But mm-hmm. the torture that they did psychologically to him was to say, you're never going home. Now you're never going to get out. You're going to die in this 4-foot-high cage, right? They made him lose hope. And when he lost hope, he got to the point of wanting to commit suicide, right? He was done. But he talked about the other prisoners who weren't allowed to talk, but they had some code that they could tap, and how they began to work with him and how they began to talk to him and how others would help feed him because he couldn't move his arms anymore because they'd rebroken his arms. Mm. In his mind, they were the heroes. And he was so ashamed of what it was that he had done. But by him being ashamed, I became so ashamed of who I was, right? It was like, yeah. Oh my gosh, I've never done anything to sacrifice for my country the way that you sacrificed mm-hmm. for your country. I think what we fail to do is to recognize how many of these heroes that are out there, and they are much more abundant than you think, much more abundant. They're in our firehouses, they're in our police stations, they're in our schools. You can find them with the individual who are struggling to fix the carburetor on their car or pay their taxes or just get their kids through school on a weekly basis, or the not just the big entrepreneurs who are making massive changes.
But those who are just surviving the day-to-day
existence.
The
ones who are trying to figure out day-to-day how to be able to get it done.
Mm-hmm. And be a better person or a better parent.
And then if you get lost then go to the cemeteries. You know, go to Arlington or go to the places where 9/11 victims are buried, mm-hmm. and you'll realize we are standing on the shoulder of giants, and we're doing it to create something that is really unbelievable and unprecedented in human history, which is to focus on the individual, to empower the individual, not most of the individuals, as many individuals as we can. Mm-hmm. And through that, creating a superpower that has never been seen before on the history of this planet, like we've been able to do here.
I'm glad that you mentioned the shame that you experienced, you know, when you were hearing of his story and his resilience. And it, I mean, to me, I just hear that that's imbued with just so much deep, deep respect and honor. And I think, you know, just based on what you just said, if you were to tell that to somebody who is extremely depressed and feeling very hopeless, it would probably make them feel more ashamed. It's like, well, I don't have anything that I can feel hopeful for. Like, I'm feeling even more inadequate and incompetent mm-hmm. because that's not something that I hold true in my belief system. And I think what I would say, or how I would translate that for that person, I would say, just start somewhere. It doesn't have to be perfect. Just start connecting. The biggest thing you can do to pull yourself out of a depression is just start giving to a community. We oftentimes have social comparisons in our mind. If you can think of, and it might even be like volunteering at an animal shelter, it pulls you out of your own misery. You can't at the same time feel the sense of despair and hopelessness and misery for yourself if you feel like you're helping a group that is more deserving. And it could be any group.
So I think you're right. The power of that story, mm-hmm. and the whole reason I started that story, mm-hmm. was Senator McCain took one extra step and came back and shook my hand, right? I'm not sure I was feeling connected by hating him.
Yeah.
I don't think I was feeling connected to anybody by hating him. You can't feel connected to the human race by hating someone else, mm-hmm. either through social media or in person. But by extending out his hand to somebody who didn't have his same ideas, who mm-hmm. saw the world a little differently, and building a friendship,
joined you.
We both, I know he enriched my life. I can't say that I enriched his, but I know he enriched mine. He made an incredible difference. And it committed me to this idea. Never again will I hate somebody because of their politics. Mm-hmm. I just won't do it, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't mean that if I think that they're doing terrible wrong things that I won't dislike them. But just because of who they are politically, that's not a justification for mm-hmm. hating. That's mm-hmm. a justification for listening and trying to understand mm-hmm. and seeing if you can find common ground. And if you're trying to figure out, well, how do we deal with these huge divisions in this country? Mm-hmm. Find somebody on the other side and walk across and shake their hand.
Yeah, and that is wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know you well enough to know how much it's just you're a flowing river. You know, you're the quintessential giving back to community. And I admire people like you. I think, oh my gosh, it's just, you know, so much energy and time and commitment, but you do it without even thinking.
Well, part of it's self-serving, right? You like Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand says it's okay for us to recognize why being good actually benefits us.
To be
right?
Self-serving.
That's right.
It's okay to be self-serving through your actions.
I like to think about it like this. Mm-hmm. Think about who is the tribal chief. And just think about these two people, two incredibly strong people who are in the tribe. Which one of these two would you imagine are the leader? Here's the one. He goes out and shoots the biggest game in the field, and he brings it home. And you see, oh my gosh, he's so strong, he's so powerful, he's such a great hunter, and look at that big beast that he's mm-hmm. eating and that he's clothing his tent with and that he's utilizing to be able to make other swords. Now, here's the other guy. He captures something, kills something, brings it back home. Maybe it's not as big, but he shares with other people. Mm-hmm. He takes care of the weakest inside the tribe first. He makes certain that the old and the seniors and the women are served. He takes the rug and makes it into a rug for someone else. Mm-hmm. Which one of those two are you going to make the leader, right? If you want to be the leader, if you really want to be self-serving, start with thinking about the other people. Now, mm-hmm. I can promise you that even if you start with that goal, you're going to feel really good about giving back to other people because there's something magical to it, something that's special. And there are lots of ways that you can do it. You know, when I was mayor, we had I had a woman who was, her son was valedictorian of her school. And he ended up being shot in a drive-by shooting and killed. So I went to the funeral. I didn't know the family, but there were so many drive-by shootings happening that I decided to go. And as I walked through the line, she grabbed me and she said, Mayor, there had to be something you could have done that would have saved my son's life, and you didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Now, I told her I was sorry. I walked on. I did all the right public things, but I stewed. Yeah. I was upset. Right?
And you felt personally responsible.
First, mm-hmm. I felt like it wasn't fair. Mm-hmm. How could she be blaming me? What was it that I did? But I really spent time thinking about it. And when I spent time thinking about it, I began to think about my responsibility. I began
in
to become...
In a position of power.
I was in a position mm-hmm. of power. What was I really doing? How was I trying to make a difference? Now, I went back to her and I talked to her and I said, okay. I said, you're right. There are things that I need to do, but I can't do it alone. I need people to help. And so we created this organization called Mothers Against Gangs. We began to try to put forward a whole series of initiatives. I ended up being sued for the kids' gun law by the NRA. I ended up being sued by the ACLU for my kids' curfew program. And the kids' curfew program was an interesting one. And to me, this is kind of where the leadership came in. So when we passed it, we ended up only putting it into place because there were minorities that said, do not do this in my district. Mm-hmm. So we did it only in a wealthy part of Phoenix. And sure enough, we ended up arresting a young teenager whose parents were wealthy at 2 o'clock in the morning. She was a straight A student. And the police department came in and said, okay, this is going to be a disaster. We're going to look bad. And what you should do, please just don't criticize the police department until we get through the case. If you can just not say anything for a while, right? Mm-hmm. And my answer to that was, no, that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to speak up. So I did a press conference. In this press conference, I talked about the concept that this was young girl, was a straight A student. She had done all the right things. She was living a good life, but she was out on the street at 2 a.m. And I said, you know what? Good kids die when they're hit by stray bullets every bit as easy as bad kids do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you want me to start enforcing this rule based upon good kids and bad kids, how do I define what that standard is?
Yeah, exactly. How do you...
What rule are you going to have me put into place?
Or the context.
It's 2 a.m. There's the standard. Now, to be fair, we didn't do it in the minority districts. So that leader came back to me and she said, hey, I'm really upset about this. And I know the reason that you didn't do it was because our Hispanic leader in that area didn't want it. And I'm going to go in and I'm gonna attack her. And I said, okay, you really want to get this done? She said, yeah. I go, don't attack her, attack me. Mm-hmm. She said, what? I said, yeah, come into the room and attack me. And say, it's not fair. It's not fair that you didn't put this into our neighborhood. It's not fair that you didn't do it. And I says, I don't even care if you say, I think it's a bit racist to not do it. She did exactly that. It was amazing how the minority leadership immediately
galvanized and came together.
Said, we deserve this program too.
That's
now,
right.
I love those minority leaders of those neighbors. I became very close friends with them. And in fact, in many ways, they made the program better. One of the things they did is they said, hey, instead of taking these kids to a jail, what if we take them to a parks facility? And what if we have the parks people work with them? And what if we have diversion programs
and
for
mentoring
them that got in trouble?
Programs.
It was a mixture of these two sets
after
of ideas.
Programs,
we're
going to
have rules, and then we're
going to
create diversions. Mm-hmm. We reduced juvenile violence for the last 3 summers I was mayor by 70%. They were huge numbers, but they participated. However,
and I remember you even mentioning if they did get picked up after hours, if there were these teenagers who got picked up, they got to go to, wasn't it a park?
Yeah, they'd go to a park facility.
And
the
it
park
was
facility
a supervised
now,
park
I
facility.
I can tell you when the parents had to come and
they
pick them up
at 2 in
the morning,
didn't go to juvenile detention center.
The fact that their kids were playing ping pong didn't make them any happier.
Right?
The parents weren't ticked off. But yeah. the point I'm giving is this. What a leader does is they take the blame when things go wrong and they give away the credit when things go right. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you're giving. There are lots of ways to give in society. You can give by creating a better product.
I think
as
that's
an
also a good parent.
Right? You can give back by being a good parent. You can give back by mowing your lawn and making certain that your house looks nice. Mm-hmm. You can give back by taking part in other service programs. But when you do, and when you're doing it for other people, trying to empower them and to make them better, not only are you going to make society better, I guarantee you, you're going to make your life better.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the people that I work with who have, you know, such low self-worth or self-value, they would probably have a really hard time seeing what it is that I have to give back. You know, what do I have for my life? My life is just filled with loss and trauma. And again, you know, their perception of themselves is filtered through this negative outlook. But I would say you are who you are. You have the opportunity to transform yourself as a result of the trauma that you've experienced and the healing.
So we're coming close to the end of the hour. So let's go to the four lessons.
Mm-hmm.
The first lesson that I want to focus on is our society focused on individuals. Clearly we did that, but while we focused on individuals, no one did it alone. You hear these people who say, I did it without anyone else's help. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is, that's not true. They're a whole group of people whose shoulders that you stand upon.
Be grateful.
that gave you your ability to do what you're doing. And that not only includes our founders, that not only includes the people who created the inventions that you created your invention from, but it also includes your school teachers and police officers. And it's a whole tribe, a whole society. And we all participated. And all of us empowering the individual is what allowed you to find that success. To me, that's lesson one. We focused on the individual, but you didn't do it alone.
Beautiful. You know, I just want to go back to a story I was about to tell, because I think it's poignant and relevant to our points here. So I know a woman whose son was tragically killed, and she decided to start going on speaking tours and talk about what had happened to her son and what laws and legislations need to be passed as a result. But more importantly, she spoke about her suffering. She found meaning in her suffering. She found purpose in talking about the loss and the tragedy she endured as a mother, and the horror and the terror that she was confronted with the despair and the loss of her son in the tragic way that it did. And afterwards, I asked her,
What's the lesson from that?
I said, how did you find the courage to speak about such a personal loss? She said, if I can prevent one mother from having that loss that I endured, it is all worth it. And she wasn't thinking about herself. She wasn't thinking about what she gained. In fact, she was giving. It was exhausting for her.
Yeah, I think the lesson to that is, our second lesson, which is that there's a conflict sometimes between how you service others and how you service yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason when you get onto the airplane that it tells you, hey, put the oxygen mask on yourself before your child if we have a problem. Why? Because you can't help other people if you haven't serviced yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you are harming yourself by doing too much service to others, you're really not helping anybody.
Yeah, that's
You have to focus on loving yourself as well and knowing that, hey, when I service other people, I feel better. But don't get so carried away that you begin to do damage to yourself or to your family or to people that you care about. You can service both at the same time. To me, that's the lesson.
Yes. Yeah. And she was benefiting others and also empowering other individuals through sharing of her story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. A third lesson to me is you belong to something bigger, you know, and respect and appreciate that that thing that you belong to is amazing. That thing is called America. You are in an unbelievable place at an unbelievable point of time. And you can be very proud of what it is that you're a part of.
Yes, and be careful about judging your own life by the standard of perfection or judging others' lives by the standard of perfection. We have to look at driving forward what are the more important issues of our greatest value, and that is protecting the individual rights, giving back to community, allowing your identity to be formed and shaped and influenced by your contribution towards others. There is so much mental health benefit from social cohesion and giving back to a sense of community that you feel like you belong to. Take that next step. Share. It may be your wisdom. It may be your life experiences. It might be your knowledge. It might be your talents. Don't hesitate. Mm-hmm. Take that next step.
And the last lesson that maybe we'll use is to hold our heroes dear. Mm-hmm. It's to recognize that that these heroes that we have, they are the people who have protected individual liberty. And respecting them and honoring them ensures us that we continue to respect individual liberty. Don't be the one that's knocking them down. It's okay to talk about things that they did that were wrong. Just make certain that you put it in perspective with the amazing things that they did right. So, Dr. Bhatia, thank you very much. We appreciate
being on
our show, talking about agency.
Lively topic.
Yeah, it's fun. We'll see. Thank you very much. This is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American, and we're here talking about hope, and we're very happy to have you on our show. We hope that you'll push that subscribe button to help us continue our work. Thanks for joining The Optimistic American Show. Help us grow by subscribing to our channel. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a like and a comment. There is so much more that we have planned. We can't wait for you to embark upon this journey with us.